Let me welcome you to Trinity Presbyterian Church. I'm Roland Barnes. I'm the senior pastor here at Trinity Church. It's our privilege to be able to provide this lecture to you this evening. It is, in a sense, due to a 40-year in the past discipleship relationship that my wife and I had to a college student named Marietta Hudspeth, who happens to be best friends with Dr. Schaefer's wife. So Dr. Schaefer was here back in 1999 to give a lecture at Georgia Southern University, and that was when I first met him, and he remembered me, I remembered him. So as he was invited here to do some speaking here at the chemistry department at Georgia Southern University, he contacted me to see if we might be interested in having him come speak here, and we're delighted to do so. Dr. Schaefer, of course, is at the University of Georgia, where he's working with computational chemistry, whatever that is. I'll try to get him to explain that to you, possibly. He is originally a Midwesterner, born in Grand Rapids, Michigan, educated in Syracuse, New York, and also a degree from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and also a degree, PhD degree in physics from Stanford University. After being a professor in California, he came to his senses and came to the great state of Georgia, the Empire State of the South. We're very pleased to have him come to speak with us tonight. He brought along a couple of books. And how do you want to handle these? They're just gifts?
Up to you.
Okay, so there are 6 copies of his book, Science and Christianity. Now there are only 5. And they'll be up front if you'd like to take advantage of that. Dr. Schaefer, thank you so much for making yourself available to us. Welcome.
Electrified? Lost my voice yesterday in class and woke up this morning and said, you know, I wonder if it's going to work. I asked my wife, Karen. Where is Karen? Right there. I asked her, are we going to do this? And she said, we're going to do it. So I did give 2 lectures in chemistry department at Georgia Southern. Feels all right. I do have the elixir here, and the contents of this will not be revealed to anyone, but it will only be used if necessary. So it's great to be with my friend Roland again. He's a neat guy. Yeah, he's a neat guy no matter what he says. Fun to be here. So this is my talk, The Worldviews of Great Scientists, and let's see if I can make this work. Well, it hasn't worked yet. Oh, there we are. This is where we work. This is the Center for Computational Quantum Chemistry at the University of Georgia. It's a great new building and a privilege to be there. Special place to be. This is 2 weeks old. Picture I'm my research group. This is what I get paid to do. At 15 PhD students. We are now recruiting for the class of 2022. One commitment from the state of Oregon. One commitment from the state of Michigan. And we'll see. We need 3 or 4 new PhD students every year to keep this going. And they are just a very special group of people. One person here who's got the gray beard, that's Justin Turney. He's my assistant. He keeps things going when I'm in Statesboro and other places. So this is probably the most productive and best research group I've ever had. There's one person who's cut off there in the corner, James Morgan. You can just see a sliver of him. He's from Georgia Southern. Most of these kids are from the Midwest, but he's from Georgia Southern. And his is an interesting story. He went to Virginia Tech, and I don't know if he flunked out or he was encouraged to leave, but he went into the military for a while, got that over. Georgia Southern was the only place that would take him. He graduated with a very mediocre degree here, But he started doing research with Professor Ryan Fortenberry. Ryan, are you here somewhere? Ryan's right here. And this guy wrote a brilliant master's degree thesis. Just amazing. So he applies to me, and I'm looking at this record, and I said, Ryan, this is not the kind of material we're looking for at the University of Georgia. And we talked on the phone, and he said, you know, this is extraordinary. I talked to my former student, Tim Lee, who runs a big lab in NASA lab in California. He knew James. He said, Prof, got to take this guy. I don't care what his GPA looks like. So we took him. He's been with us for two and a half years. He's doing great. So this is we have one other Georgian, Avery Weens, second one. Four of these people didn't show up for the photograph. Second one over, she's from Buckhead and National Science Foundation graduate research fellow. Just wonderful. So this is fun. This is a great job. I'm just getting into it, just enjoying it. Worldview. Everybody has one. Formed out of his or her own experiences, there are a lot of different worldviews, but everybody has one, whether they thought about it or not. When they're freshmen at the University of Georgia, they mostly not thought about it. So we try to help them. Carefully thought out worldview reflects the deep hunger among every human being, no exceptions, for an overarching framework to bring unity to their lives. I'm going to quote C.S. Lewis here. I'm teaching a C.S. Lewis seminar this semester. We just meet one hour a week, but it's fun. And this is what got me giving lectures like this one, is hearing people say so many times, science has disproved God. And this is why C.S. Lewis was not a Christian until he reached the age of 30 or 31. This is from his little book, Surprised by Joy, the autobiography of his early life. He says, "You will understand that my atheism was inevitably based on what I believe to be the findings of the sciences. I had to take, and these findings, not being a scientist, I had to take on trust, in fact, on authority." Now, C.S. Lewis never took any course in science. He was not a nerd, I'll tell you. If anybody's in doubt, we embrace nerdness. We embrace nerdness. Okay? And that was true even before Bill Gates said nerds will rule the world. C.S. Lewis never took a course in science, and he was supposed to take a mathematics test to be accepted as an undergraduate at Oxford, and he failed it several times. And finally, he came back from World War I as a wounded veteran, and they let him in despite the... So he knew nothing about science at all, but somebody had told him, authoritatively, Roland, that science had disproved God, and he bought it for a long time. I have many things to share here. I don't know how many of these I want to share, either before you all go to sleep or I get lose my voice. But this is from Erwin Schrödinger, Nobel Prize in physics. Established the Schrödinger equation, the most important equation in science. This is what Professor Fortenberry and I do for a living. We solve Schrödinger's equation. And there's a little more here. Let's see if I can get a little more. This is a pretty good statement. Okay, this is what Schrödinger did. Oh, thank you. It's great. And he says this. He's a little bit older. This is 20 years after he's gotten the Nobel Prize. And he makes this amazing statement. "I am very astonished that the scientific picture of the real world around me is very deficient." Very deficient, Schrödinger says. He says it gives us a lot of factual information, puts all our experience in a magnificently kissed sense of order, but is ghastly silent about everything that matters to us. Science cannot tell us a word about red and blue, bitter and sweet, physical pain and physical delight. It knows nothing of beautiful and ugly, good or bad, God and eternity. Science sometimes pretends to answer questions in these domains, but the answers are very often so silly that we're not inclined to take them seriously. This is a statement against what C.S. Lewis liked to call scientism or scientific imperialism, or logical positivism, or reductionism. Beulah's right next to Karen, isn't she? Karen, you're next to Beulah? So Beulah, stand up. Beulah is my student. Stand up. She is my student. She graduated from UGA 5 years ago, and now she's a faculty member at Georgia Southern, so we are very proud of her. She's a very special person in our lives. And Karen, did you give her the water bottle? Okay. She came and spent a night with us a few months ago and left us this beautiful turquoise water bottle, and I promised that we would bring it back to her, and I almost left it at home this morning, but I found it. And now, there it is. There it is. All right. So Beulah, very, very delighted to see her. Wonderful young Christian woman. And now this is kind of sobering. This is an interview between Chandrasekhar, Nobel Prize winner in physics 1983, and his biographer, Wally. And it's a nice biography. I encourage you to read it. But it has a very sobering interview. This book has been reviewed many times, Physics Today, Science, Nature, many distinguished scientific journals, and all of the reviews go back to this little bit in the back of the book, which is an interview. This is after the book has been written, and the author of the book is astonished with what he hears. And Chandrasekhar begins this discussion and says, "In fact, I consider myself an atheist, but I have a feeling of discontentment, because the hope for contentment, a peaceful outlook on life as a result of pursuing a goal has remained unfulfilled." And his biographer doesn't get it. He says, "What? I don't understand. What in the world are you talking about?" So you mean single-minded pursuit of science, understanding parts of nature, and comprehending nature with such enormous success still leave you with a feeling of disappointment? And he says, "I don't really have a sense of disappointment." Now, the author is going to try to backtrack on this a little bit. And so he says, "Chandrasekhar, all I've done seems not to be very much." Now, we need to go forward here. And this does not... Yeah, that's where we are. Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, so the poor author is stuck in this embarrassing situation. He's written this 300-page biography of this guy, and he doesn't really understand him. And he's saying, Chandrasekhar is saying, "I don't have a feeling of contentment at all." And his biographer is just scrambling for anything. He says, "Don't you think this is common to everybody?" Chandrasekhar says, "Well, it may be, but he's not giving a lot of ground here." He says this, "The fact that other people experience it doesn't change the fact that one is experiencing it. It doesn't become less personal on that account." And he says, "What is true for my own personal case is that I simply do not have that sense of harmony which I had hoped for when I was young." And now, this last little bit, I'd like to get all my entering PhD students to read this, because I want them to understand that although science is a wonderful thing, and I'm very passionate about it, it is not an end in and of itself. And Chandrasekhar is going to say this. He says, "And I have persevered in science for over 50 years. The time I have devoted to other things is minuscule." If you think science in and of itself is a worldview, you need to think more seriously about this, because Chandrasekhar thought about it a lot longer than you have and concluded otherwise. You know, I hate to say this, but we are. This is going to happen again. I wonder. Yeah, I don't think we want to keep going like this for too long, do we? Want to try another one? Yeah, let's try another one. You know, what we're told to do in these situations in the South is shuck and jive. Roland has said, "Why don't you tell us why you become a Christian? You can do that without PowerPoint, can't you?" And it was a long story. You know, I became a Christian during my fourth year as a professor at the University of California at Berkeley. I was a professor at Berkeley for 18 years, and during my fourth year, I became a Christian. I'd been thinking about spiritual things for a fair amount of time, I think I can honestly say. At age 17, I began to read the Bible, which was completely radical in my family. And I read a chapter in the Bible every day for 11 years before I became a Christian. A little slow on the uptake, you might say. This became more serious on Easter Sunday, 1969. This was right about the time I graduated with my PhD from Stanford University. Karen and I went to a little church in Menlo Park, right across the street from the Stanford Linear Accelerator, where 15 Nobel Prizes have been given for the work done there. And it was a small, beautiful church, all redwood, gorgeous church. The minister was an Englishman, John Burns was his name, and he gave, in the families we grew up in, I mean, people went to church on Easter. I mean, nobody could be that lost. I'm pretty sure I was either taken to church or went to church every Easter Sunday of my life. I think so. We did it. Growing up in the Midwest, something people do. And the church that I grew up in was really a good one. Grace Episcopal Church in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And Jerry Ford, future president of the United States, was a member of the church. He and my dad were best friends growing up. And Jerry Ford was there. And if you wanted to join the Kent Country Club, it was easier to get into Grace Episcopal Church than into the Kent Country Club. So you wanted to be in Grace Episcopal Church to get into the Kent Country Club. I mean, this was a place in Grand Rapids where a lot of stuff was going on. So, we were in the best church. I mean, it was the best place. And Jerry Ford actually became a Christian eventually. Not much due to Grace Episcopal Church in Grand Rapids, though. But when he passed, Karen and I watched this whole ceremony for about 2 hours, and I thought, this is all going back through my old church. I was as lost, a lost soul as anybody could be, and there's Jerry Ford, and Jimmy Carter's there talking about his faith too, and wow, things have changed. Well, things hadn't really changed. It's only what was going on for that day that changed. Now, let's see if this will go here, okay? And then maybe I'll return to my story. The bottom line of my story is God's very patient. Oh, good. Okay. Alan Lightman talks about this business of, has science disproved God? And he says that references to God or divine purpose continued in the scientific literature until middle to late 1800s. Seems likely that the lack of religious references thereafter is more from a change in social and professional convention among scientists than from any change in underlying thought. Indeed, and this is the bottom line, contrary to popular myth, scientists appear to have the same range of attitudes about religious matters as does the general public. Yep. So has science disproved God? Not according to Alan Lightman. So a few examples. Eugene Wigner, born in a comfortable Jewish family in Budapest, along with others, a Jewish scientist, became extremely distinguished. Wigner got the Nobel Prize. Moved to Princeton at a good time, when he was still alive, and got the Nobel Prize in physics. Used to like to talk about the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics. Now, not all of our students feel that way about mathematics. I have had students who have told me straight up, I do not think that mathematics is, not only I don't think it's effective, it's not certainly not unreasonably effective, but Wigner felt differently. The unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics, and remarked that, quote, the miracle of the appropriateness of the language of mathematics for the formulation of the laws of physics is a wonderful gift that we neither understand nor deserve. Wigner found his way into the Protestant church eventually in Princeton, and you can read about that in his autobiography, which is it's readable, but he's not a biographer, that's clear. Why might a scientist become a Christian? Well, maybe comprehensibility of the universe, the fact that we can understand it, points to a sovereign creator God. Possible reason. Mathematical physics might make you do it. Laws of nature look just as if they've been selected as the most simple and elegant principles for understandable change by a wise creator. Belief in the decipherability of nature strongly suggests the existence of a cosmic mind who can construct nature in accordance with rational laws. And let me quote C.S. Lewis again. I'm giving this lecture at Cambridge a week from Tuesday. So this is the warm-up. This is the warm-up. They want a different title, but it's the same talk.
I will.
I'll tell them I've been to Statesboro and seen Roland Barthes. You know, this is it. This is from Mere Christianity. This is so good. Yeah, Lewis just says some things are so good. He says, atheism turns out to be too simple. If the whole universe has no meaning, we should never have found out that it has no meaning. Blaise Pascal, some of you will be familiar with me, our little book group that my wife and I are involved in, read the Pensées a few years back, father of mathematical theory of probability, combinatorial analysis, one of the great physicists and mathematicians of all times. I would say, Roland might disagree with me about this, I would say the only physical scientist to make profound contributions to Christian thinking. These are in the Pensées, published in 1670. Pensées is French for the thoughts. I had to read this at MIT as a sophomore. They were determined to civilize the nerds. We had to take a humanities course every single semester for 8 semesters. It didn't really work, and this requirement is no longer there. But we read the Pensées, and I thought it was pretty good. Didn't get anything out of it, but it seemed okay. I should have paid attention. Yeah, I didn't pick this up at all, that Pascal's theology was centered on the person of Jesus Christ as Savior and based on personal experience. I didn't get that, and I didn't get anything like this, or didn't understand it. I read it. Maybe some of you have had the same experience. I read it, but it just didn't register. Pascal, Pensées, God makes people conscious of their inward wretchedness and his infinite mercy unites himself to the inmost soul, fills it with humility and joy, with confidence and love, renders them incapable of any end other than himself. Jesus Christ is the end of all and the center to which all tends. I read that, but didn't mean anything. Michael Faraday, this discovery of benzene, one of his lesser accomplishments. My friend John Thomas in England has written a wonderful essay in which he claims that if Faraday had lived into the Nobel Prize era, he would have gotten at least 6 Nobel Prizes. He died shortly before the Nobel Prizes began, so he didn't get any Nobel Prizes. Discovered benzene, electromagnetic induction, inventor of the generator, main architect of classical field. Generally agreed to be the greatest experimental scientist of all time. Like the rest of us, he came to the end of his distinguished scientific career, and a well-wisher came by on his deathbed and said, "Sir Michael, what speculations do you have now?" Now, this may seem a little bit strange. I have not spent a lot of time around people dying. I bet you have. More than you'd like to have. The main feeling when you're around somebody who's dying this far, is say anything to lighten the situation. Now, if they don't know Jesus, you need to be more serious. But otherwise, you want to lighten the situation. This is what this guy wanted to do. I mean, he knows Faraday, and he knows the way Faraday did science, which was to speculate. That is to say, develop a hypothesis and experiments to either prove it or disprove it. And he'd go into the lab, do it, and the nature of his speculations was that whether the results turned out as he anticipated or otherwise, it was an important result nevertheless. So not such a crazy thing to say. But Faraday was nevertheless a little surprised to hear it. He said, "Speculations, I have none. I have certainties. I thank God I don't rest my dying head upon speculation, for I know whom I have believed and am persuaded that he is able to keep that which I have committed unto him against that day." And these words were 1,800 years old at the time from Paul's letter, second letter to Timothy. So Michael Faraday, greatest experimentalist of all time, a deeply committed Christian. James Clerk Maxwell, the second of the three great theoretical physicists. Of course, Isaac Newton first, Maxwell, then Einstein. And he, this is from the Big Green Book, the Biographical Dictionary of Sciences. It gives you one page on every famous scientist. And it starts out well. It says, "Maxwell possessed all the gifts necessary for revolutionary advances in theoretical physics." On the right track here. "Profound grasp of physical reality, great mathematical ability," and now it goes wrong. "Total absence of preconceived notions." If you have a total absence of preconceived notions, you're going to come up with a total absence of science. I mean, you've got to have some, and we just talked about this with Michael Faraday, you have to have some preconceived notions or you're going nowhere. So I don't think this guy Williams is a scientist. Anyway, so he's wrong about that. "Creative imagination of the highest order, of course. He possessed also the gift to recognize the right task for this genius, the mathematical interpretation of Faraday's concept of the electromagnetic field. Successful completion of this task, the Maxwell's equations, resulting in the field equations bearing his name, constituted one of the great achievements of the human intellect." I had to take, at MIT, it was pretty rigid. We all took the same courses. All of us, all 900 took the same courses. And in the first semester of the sophomore year, we had to take electromagnetism, and the first thing you do is learn Maxwell's equations. And there are four of them, and it's a bit of a shock the first time, but we had a student in our class who was entrepreneurial in nature. And this student printed out 900, number of people in the freshman class, T-shirts with Maxwell's equations on the front and Maxwell's equations on the back, and we wore these things to the first exam. And the physics professor was in a state of apoplexy. He was some old German guy. He didn't speak a word in English the entire time. He's marching around, goose-stepping around the auditorium like this and really, really mad. And the average on the quiz was 98.3. It was so cool. It was just so great. And second exam, the average was 17%. Maxwell. Here's "This Is Good" by Maxwell. "Think what God has determined to those who submit themselves to his righteousness and are willing to receive his gift, that is the gift of eternal life in Jesus Christ. They are to be conformed to the image of his Son. And when they're fulfilled and God sees that they are conformed to the image of Christ, there can be no more condemnation." James Clerk Maxwell. Now, we're going to skip this. You know, that's going to pass. Now, if you go to Cambridge, as I will in, oh my goodness, I'm going to Indiana, I'm going to California, then I'm going to Cambridge. I mean, this is a crazy semester. And yeah, anyway, if you go to Cambridge, if you go on the walking tour, it's so cool. It goes on for about 3 hours, and it's really neat. And the high point is when you get to the old Cavendish Laboratory. And you get to the old Cavendish Laboratory, and the tour guide, who's obviously British, says, and it's a museum now, it's no bigger than this room, the Cavendish Laboratory. He said, "In this laboratory, 17 Nobel Prizes were achieved." Brief pause, "More than the entire nation of France." At this point, all the French people leave the tour. And we carry on. Well, over the door to the old cabin, there's something in Latin. So I took my daughter Charlotte with me there one time, and she read it. And it says, well, of course, a room this size wasn't big enough. So they built a new Cavendish lab outside the city. It's where I go jogging when I go from St. Catherine's College. So I took my daughter there, and it's in English now. It's still the same thing from 1980, but over the door it says, "The works of the Lord are great, sought out of all them that have pleasure therein." This is in Latin on the old Cavendish. So what's the bottom line in science? The works of the Lord are great. Dal Ratch, in a book published by Oxford in 2004, kind of summarizes what I've been attempting to say so far. Okay, he says this: most distinguished scientists historically were religious believers. Specifically, they were Christians. Therefore, what may be said about those who insist that science and Christianity are incompatible? What shall we say? And this is what Ratch says: regrettably, we must attribute to such persons intellectual blindness, self-deception, or hypocrisy. Their implausible accusation of the incompatibility of science and Christianity would indict the majority of scientists who ever lived as not grasping what they were doing. It's a pretty strong statement, but I think there's something to it. Scientists, Christians, these are all dead. These are all living. Okay, so let's talk, and we want to, I want to ask the question, is science any different than the rest of the intellectual world as far as Christian belief is concerned? And the answer is that it is. Let me give you the hall of, so here's the hall of fame of the sciences. I mean, they're all on there. Let me give you the hall of fame of the humanities. Thomas Hobbes, Spinoza, Voltaire, Hume, Rousseau, these are all bigs. Kant, Gibbon, Bentham, Hegel, Emerson, Feuerbach, Thoreau, and Nietzsche. What do all these people in the Hall of Fame of the Humanities have in common? Oh, well, they're all atheists, agnostics, skeptics, at best deists. So the Hall of Fame of the Humanities is quite different from the Hall of Fame of the Sciences. There is something peculiarly friendly to Christians about the scientists, okay? Now, something happened here. I thought we were back to that again. Now, I want to bring things up to date here, and I'll give you a few more dead white males, but then we're going into the present tense. And Arthur Schawlow, one of my professors at Stanford, Nobel Prize in Physics, 1981, Schawlow was a remarkable person. He was approximately spherical. About that tall, about that wide, about that deep. Approximately spherical. And some of you have heard stories that large people are unhappy. And I'm telling you, it's not true. Arthur Schawlow was certainly in the physics department at Stanford the most joyful professor by far. Everybody loved him. We called him Artie behind his back, Professor Schawlow, when we were in his presence. And he identified himself as an Orthodox Protestant Christian. And this is an interesting statement that he made. And he's comparing the New Testament to the results of his scientific research. Schawlow says this: "We're fortunate to have the Bible, and especially the New Testament, which tells us so much about God in widely accessible human terms." Now, Schawlow believed, really to the core of his being, that everything he learned from science about laser spectroscopy at low temperatures was telling him more about what might be called the mind of God. But he did not believe that what he was learning was widely accessible in human terms. So he contrasts that with the New Testament, I think, very wisely. This is a letter from my friend Rick Smalley. Rick Smalley is no longer with us, but Rick was... I don't have time to get into that too much. Rick's been gone for a while, father of nanotechnology, Nobel Prize in Chemistry, 1996. Rick was a very determined atheist. He knew I was a Christian. He took every opportunity to try to explain to me that this was not true. And about 5 years before he passed, an amazing change came into his life. He became a Christian. Everything changed. It was just just remember, this is after he got the Nobel Prize. This happened at about age 55. And let's see how he describes this, okay? Let's see how he describes this. He wrote, recently I've gone back to church. He hadn't entered a church in 40 years, I guarantee you. He was with a new focus to understand, as best I can, what it is that makes Christianity so vital and powerful in the lives of billions of people today, even though almost 2,000 years have passed since the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And here he says what it is. Although I suspect I'll never fully understand, I think the answer is very simple. It's true. He was not looking for truth, but he found it anyway. Remarkable story. And his whole life changed. It was just wonderful. He got baptized at the Second Baptist Church in Houston. And at his memorial service, all his atheist friends came, and they were just gagging when they walked out of the church. It was just more than they could tolerate. We'll skip this. Back to C.S. Lewis, in Little Book Miracles. I like this book. Some people consider this to be a failure. I don't think so. I think he does a good job in it. He says, men became scientific because they expected law in nature. And they expected law in nature because they believed in a legislator. Bob Griffiths, Carnegie Mellon University, when he received one of the most distinguished prizes of the American Physical Society, the Heinemann Prize, there's a little story about him in Physics Today. Physics Today is kind of like the Time magazine of physics community. And it describes him in this way. It says he's an evangelical Christian. Griffiths also is an amateur theologian, helps teach a course on Christianity and science. And then they asked him this. And he gave what do you do when you need an atheist for a debate? He said, if I need an atheist for a debate, I go to the philosophy department. The physics department isn't much use. The fraction of philosophers that are atheists is a lot higher than the fraction of physicists. He's sponsoring my lecture in 12 days, Robert White. He's a smart guy. Fellow of the Royal Society, Cambridge professor. He does volcanoes. He became a household word for a brief period of time when those volcanoes were going off in Iceland and Delta Airlines had to cancel all their flights and lost a lot of money. He was on CNN, every BBC, the whole works, talking about volcanoes. And he's quite a good communicator. Hopefully he's going to say something nice about me a week from Tuesday. And this is his statement. So he's just a youngster. I can say with certainty that over the years, as my Christian understanding has grown, it has done nothing but fill me with greater certainty that the Christian gospel is truth. Truth that the world desperately needs to hear, and that I am completely unworthy of the grace God has shown me. That's pretty good. You like that, Roland? That's not bad for a physicist. Yeah. John Suppey, I know reasonably well. He's now retired as a professor from Princeton University. He does tectonics, is his thing. His story is kind of like mine. As I said, I became a Christian during my fourth year as a professor at Berkeley. He became a Christian during his early years at Princeton. And he says this. He says he was vaguely aware of his spiritual needs, began attending services in the Princeton Chapel, then reading the Bible and other Christian books. He eventually committed himself to Christ and had his first real experience of Christian fellowship in Taiwan, where he was on a prestigious Guggenheim Fellowship. I've been to Taiwan, National Taiwan University, and spoken to this Christian fellowship, and they are pretty inspiring. Yeah, pretty inspiring people. It's good. He and I were at a conference at the University of Chicago, and he was talking about his Christian experience, and he got into it, and he began to weep. You know, he began to weep. I mean, this was very personal to him, very personal. Oh, this is from him. It says, if you know scientists and the kind of problems they have in their lives, pride, selfish ambition, jealousy, it's exactly the kind of things Jesus talked about and which he came to resolve by his death on the cross. Science is full of people with very strong egos. Isn't that the truth? Who get into conflicts with each other. True. And he says this, the gospel is the same for scientists as for anybody. Evolution is basically a red herring. If scientists are looking for meaning in their lives, it won't be found in evolution. Charlie Towns. Charlie, wonderful guy, just passed a couple years ago. Probably the most important experimental scientist of the 20th century. Discovered the laser, Nobel Prize for it in 64. But when I went to MIT as a lowly nerd, Charlie had already done the work for which he was going to get the Nobel Prize. And he'd moved to MIT as the provost, the second highest officer at MIT, because MIT thought, oh, this would be nice for us to have somebody get the Nobel Prize while the provost. Well, he got it. He hated the job. It was disgusting. Signing papers all day long, adjudicating disputes between faculty members and the dean and on. He hated it. And he stepped down and went to Berkeley, joined the faculty at Berkeley in 1966. And obviously the most distinguished faculty member at the university, and I followed after him 3 years later. This is from his book, Making Waves. Now, this is supposed to be clever. Lasers are a wave-like phenomenon. So this is supposed to be clever. He doesn't mean that he's the greatest. This is not a Cassius Clay sort of a statement. This is supposed to be fun. Okay, this is supposed to be humorous, and nerds love it. He says, just where does God come into this? He's been talking about his Christian experience, and he says, perhaps my account may give you some answer, but to me that's almost a pointless question. If you believe in God at all, there's no particular where. He's always there, everywhere. A great source of strength who's made an enormous difference to me. Whoops, let's go back. Now, Charlie is from South Carolina. He got his undergraduate degree at Furman University. It was probably Furman College back then. But and I've known Charlie for a long time. I'm going to tell you that at age 80, he had a remarkable intensifying of his Christian faith. This is quite, I don't have time to tell this story now, but it was through interacting with another physics professor at Berkeley, Ray Chow. So Charlie's from South Carolina. This is also from Making Waves, same book, especially the last chapter called Spiritual Views from a Scientific Base. And he says this, in my view, the question of origin seems always unanswered if we explore from a scientific point alone, thus I believe there's a need for some religious or metaphysical explanation. I believe in the concept of God and in his existence. John Polkinghorne, a professor at Cambridge University in mathematics, he's retired now, at Cambridge, the faculty used to be a very steep pyramid. Two professors in theoretical physics, Stephen Hawking, who I could talk about on another occasion, and John Polkinghorne. And their worldviews rather different. Polkinghorne, I take God very seriously indeed. I'm a Christian believer. And I believe that God exists and has made himself known in human terms in Jesus Christ. Oops. That's it. Alan Sandage, the greatest cosmologist, observational cosmologist of the last half of the 20th century, he did not get a Nobel Prize. He did get a $500,000 prize from the Swedish Royal Academy of Sciences for cosmology. They don't give a Nobel Prize for cosmology, but he was called the grand old man of cosmology by the New York Times, and this is his statement. The nature of God is not to be found within any part the findings of sciences. For that, one must turn to the scriptures. Becomes a Christian at age 50. Yeah, pretty interesting. Becomes a Christian at age 50. And he should have, by all rights, one knows how he should have become a Christian. He's down in the Atacama Desert at 12,000 feet, the best observatories in the world. He's got some telescope time. And he comes down there, and he's getting some fresh air. It's chilly outside. He looks upside. There's no atmosphere there at all. And you've been near there. Yeah, you've been near there. And he looks up and sees all these heavenly bodies and said, wow, God just had to do it. That is not how he became a Christian. And this is what he says. He says, he's asked this question, can a person be a scientist and also be a Christian? And he says, yes. And he says, biology made me do it. This guy's a cosmologist. He says, biology made me do it. He says, the world is too complicated in all its parts, interconnections, to be due to chance alone. I'm convinced that the existence of life with all its order in each of its organisms is simply too well put together. George Ellis. Now, I'm getting to know George Ellis pretty well. I met him in Cape Town maybe 3 years ago, and then we had dinner, Karen and I had dinner with George and his wife in Munich last summer, and we have submitted a proposal. That's what professors do. We submit proposals. Isn't that right, Ryan? That's what we do for a living, submit proposals to bring money to our university. So we have submitted a proposal together. He's an amazing scientist, co-author with Hawking, classic book, The Large-Scale Structure of Space-Time. This is truthfully the only really scientific book that Hawking ever published. This is a book about science. It sold 5,000 copies. Brief History of Time sold 20 million. But this is a book about science. This is the only book about science that Stephen Hawking ever really published, and it's good. He was also a courageous opponent of the apartheid system. He'd been a professor at the University of Cape Town for decades, and in the bad old days of apartheid, he was always in trouble. And I asked him at one point, I said, George, how did you stay out of jail? He said, well, it just didn't seem like going to jail was going to help the cause very much. So I would just hang out there right to the point where they're about to put me in the cuffs, and then I'd keep quiet for a while. And I think that was pretty effective. And of course, obviously, he was thrilled to see the changes in South Africa. This is from George. He writes, God's nature is revealed most perfectly in the life and teachings of Jesus of Nazareth, as recorded in the New Testament. Several of these people have gotten prizes worth $1.5 million, including John Barrow has too. Now, Barrow, I've known a long time. Barrow used to come to Berkeley every January and February. And he joined in this Christian fellowship group that met in my office. And very quiet guy. Very quiet guy. And I didn't really know what he was doing there. He was a lowly lecturer at the University of Sussex near Brighton on the coast of England. And it was not obvious what was going on. I eventually figured out he was a cosmologist. And I asked him one time, how come you're always here in January and February? John, you're always in Berkeley in January. I said, you ever been to England in January or February? I said, yes, I have. What was the atmosphere like? I said, well, there was a time when just to walk from one side of Oxford to the other, I had to put my hands out like this to avoid running into people in buildings. The weather's not too good. And he said, well, that's why I'm here in Berkeley in January and February. Well, he went on to become professor at Cambridge to receive this Templeton Prize for $1.5 million. Wrote the book on the fine-tuning of the universe, the anthropic cosmological principle, the brute fact that if any of a number of fundamental scientific constants is changed just a little bit, we're not here anymore. The church isn't here. The building's not here. Roland's not here. It's tough. He says, when he got this Templeton Prize, he says, I certainly don't believe there's some fundamental difference or conflict between a theistic, that is Christian, perspective on the world and the practice of science. He's a member in good standing of the Reformed Church in Cambridge. William Phillips, Nobel Prize in Physics, 97, methods to cool and trap atoms with laser light. The day he got the day the Nobel Prize was announced, there's always a press conference for anybody that gets a Nobel Prize, and he said, God has given us an incredibly fascinating world to live in and explore. It said at the press conference. It was a press conference in Long Beach. Not a great place to have a conference, but so be it. At the time, he was 48, formed and sings in the gospel choir of the Fairhaven United Methodist Church, multiracial congregation of about 300 in Gaithersburg, Maryland, 30 miles outside D.C. And that's on the first page of the New York Times. If you go to page 8, there's this thing that's very interesting. It talks about what he and his wife do every Saturday afternoon. Now, this is admittedly 20 years ago. He said, they go into inner city D.C. where they have a friend, African-American lady who's blind, is 80 years old. They take her out to do her shopping, and then they take her to dinner, and then they take her home. That's how they... So there's some genuineness there. This is not just fluff that's getting kicked up. Teaches Sunday school and leads Bible studies. My friend Don Page. Now this guy, talk about nerdness. Over the top. Don Page, Stephen Hawking's most famous student, postdoctoral fellow with Hawking, I think 76 to 79, actually lived in the home with Hawking and his wife. And his job, Hawking already had ALS. His job was to get Stephen up in the morning, get him downstairs, get some breakfast into him, and get him to the lab. And Don talks about how he always read him a little bit from the scriptures and hoping that something might happen. The answer to that is not yet. So Hawking's most famous student, and certainly for a spell, one of his closest friends. Hawking lost his voice just before A Brief History of Time was published, and so all of his friends are friends from a long way back. Here's Don Page. I'm a conservative Christian in the sense of pretty much taking the Bible seriously for what it says. Of course, I know that certain parts are not intended to be read literally, so I'm not precisely a literalist, but I try to believe in the meaning I think it is intended to have. Yeah, and a little bit more. I said, and that has appeared in many places, even in physics textbooks. And I said to him, so I went there, the University of Alberta, and gave a talk on the Big Bang Theory. And Don said, Schaefer, come into my office. I've got a couple of questions for you. Wow. It was lunchtime. I was in his office for 5 hours. There was no lunch. And he didn't have any questions. He just started talking and talking and talking and talking. You know, it's like he started up here, something you could understand. And when it was over, I mean, you were way at the center of the earth. It was really quite something. I said, okay, Don, give me something that hasn't been published before that I can use. He said, okay, here's something I scratched out. And he says this, if the universe basically is very simple, and of course, cosmologists are desperate for the universe to be simple so they can become famous, the theological implications of this would need to be worked out. Interesting. He says, perhaps the mathematical simplicity of the universe is a reflection of the personal simplicity of the gospel message that God sent his son Jesus Christ to bridge the gap between himself and us who have rejected God or rejected what he wants for us by rebelling against his will and disobeying him. And he finishes, this is a message simple enough even to be understood by children. Now, Christianity is real for Don Page. So he's got a whole house full of children from Haiti. And I got an email from last week. He's raising money for the latest of the many tragedies in Haiti. So quite a character. Chris Isham, I'm running out of examples here. Hold on. A professor of theoretical physics at Imperial College, third best university in England after Oxford and Cambridge. And Paul Davies, who writes about science as a former cosmologist, claims that Isham is Britain's greatest quantum gravity expert. Now, that's quite a statement because Stephen Hawking is British and does quantum gravity for a living. We don't need to enter that debate, but I gave a lecture on the Big Bang Theory at Imperial College, and Chris said, Schaefer, come on into my office. I got a few questions for you. This is 12 o'clock. And this is after the Don Page experience. And I'm saying, oh, no, this is going to be a day without lunch again. Well, he did ask me some questions for about an hour. And they took me to a wonderful Indian restaurant. We had a terrific lunch. So much more accommodating than Don Page. Although I've kept up with Don Page more than with Chris. And I said, as I always do when I meet these famous scientists, give me something I could show people. And this is what he gave me. He said, the God of Christianity is not only a ground of being. He's saying it's more than what Paul Tillich said. You know, do they know who Paul Tillich was? He doesn't need any more advertising than I've just given him. The God of Christianity is not only the ground of being, he's also incarnate in the person of Jesus Christ. Essential therein is the vision of the resurrection of Christ as the new creation out of the old order, and the profound notion of the redemption of time, not just a brief history of time, through the life and death of Jesus Christ. The last sentence, I want to pause a little bit for it because you could misunderstand it. This last sentence, you might think that Isham is saying that theoretical physics is not important. That's far, far from the truth. Chris Isham is passionate about theoretical physics. He has committed his entire professional life to theoretical physics, but he does say it's not the whole story. He says, I think it'll be a rather long time before theoretical physics has anything useful to add to the life and death of Jesus Christ. Again, not a statement against science at all, but of something more important. Paul Ewart, professor at Oxford, these guys are all getting very young now. Cool stuff with lasers. Cool stuff with lasers. We love this kind of stuff. Nerds just eat this stuff up. Now, this is pretty good. This is his statement. He says, Christianity makes far more sense than atheism. Well, I've given a couple possibilities for why that's the case, but he says, first, it makes sense of our rationality. Its source is ultimately God. Second, it makes sense of morality. God provides the ultimate reference for what is good. Third, it makes sense historically. The life, death, and resurrection of Jesus is evidence that he was the Logos, the Word made flesh, that is, God expressing himself in human form. Jim Tour is one of my closest friends, professor at Rice University. He's the successor to Rick Smalley as the boss of the whole nanotechnology empire at Rice University, which is still pretty near the top of the heap. Professor in many, and a wonderful friend of mine. He's a pioneer in organic nanotechnology, American Chemical Society Awards, author of the second most important paper in all of science in the year 2005. And this is from Jim. If you're interested in the web, take a look at this. jmtour.com. This is not something that's from Rice University. This is just jmtour.com. And you'll get a lot more of what he's going to say. He says, I was born and raised a Jew in the New York City area, and I remain a Jew. 1977, while a college student at Syracuse University, I came to the realization that Jesus Christ is indeed the Jewish Messiah. I asked Jesus Christ to forgive me for my sins and to come into my heart. Jim Tour. Karen knows him too, and his wife Shireen. She's from Pakistan. He's probably the most dynamic Christian I know, bar none. Case Decker, distinguished nanoscientist from Delft University of Technology, got the highest award given by the Netherlands, the Spinoza Award. That's as good as it gets. And lauded by the American Physical Society for many discoveries. I've known him for a while. And this is his statement. I gather this stuff from all these guys. Okay, I find out they're Christians, and I give me something. This is it. All my life, I've experienced a sense of wonder about the world, as well as a deep sense of purpose. So he had a sense of purpose all along. After a lot of internal thinking and external discussion, concluded that the atheistic worldview fits the reality of the world very badly. I find it, for example, utterly unconvincing that the human mind is at bottom merely a result of random atomic motions. The alternative view, where the human mind is a real entity that derives from the mind of God, appears much more rational to me. A little bit more. In the Christian worldview, I've discovered a grand story where many things fit into place. Life has purpose. The human mind is not an illusion, but real, a universal moral existence drives from God. Relations with God and our neighbor are most important. Science is a fantastic activity, amen, to explore nature for which we can honor God. History is a linear process that started with God's creative act, Big Bang, so on and so forth. Also on a personal level, I've found that living with the living God, Jesus Christ, makes my life utterly fulfilling. Andrew Briggs, back to Oxford. I think this is a good one too. He's a nano person too, one of the best in the world. Yeah, this is good. He's trying to ask all these people to try to relate their Christian faith to what they're doing scientifically. So, and he's done a good job here, I think. He says, the fusion of the worlds of information and the physical world, this is what he does for a living. This is his job. Should not come as a surprise to the Christian believer. This was foreseen in the Old Testament, where the Word of God often has the properties of something that's effective in the world. In the opening chapter of his Gospel, John describes how the Word, Jesus Christ, became physical. This one's too long. This guy's a professor in Germany. It's really good. It's one of the best statements I have, but it's too long. And so we're going to let that one go. We're going to skip the fine-tuning of the universe. Oh, we'll put this in here. Why not? Why might a scientist become a Christian? I've asked this question a couple times. Why not do it again? The extraordinary fine-tuning of the universe points to a sovereign creator God. Consider these testimonials from skeptics. Okay, so even people that don't believe anything are fascinated by this. Paul Davies, the present arrangement of matter indicates a very special choice of initial conditions. Now, normally speaking, when we use the word choice, somebody's doing the choosing. Stephen Hawking, in fact, if one considers the possible constants, scientific constants, and laws that could have emerged, the odds against a universe that has produced life like ours are immense. What's an atheist to do? Fred Hoyle, a common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as with chemistry and biology, and that there are no blind forces we're speaking about in nature. So these are things that should challenge people. Francis Collins, discovered the cystic fibrosis gene. I've got too much on him. Oh, this is what he said when he announced the first successes of the Human Genome Project. He said, and this is with Bill Clinton standing next to him, "It is humbling for me and awe-inspiring to realize that we have caught the first glimpse of our own instruction book, previously known only to God." That's a good statement. And he talks about his, why might a scientist become a Christian? Uh-oh. Well, we talked about that. Yeah, we talked about Alan Sandage. Biology made him do it. This is more in Collins, which I don't have time for. He talks about how he became a Christian. And the end of that is that fortunately, through the guidance of some very patient people who tolerated a lot of insolent questions. He was a scientific imperialist. Collins was. Scientific imperialist, patient people. I was led to read C.S. Lewis and then the Bible. And so I was led to understand many of the concepts that had completely eluded me before. And I gave my life to Christ 20 years ago. I think this is the last one. Simon Conway Morris is an evolutionist. Okay, now we have different opinions about this around here. We're not going to talk about evolution, as I tell my freshman seminar. I did take a poll yesterday on what they feel about evolution, and I'm not going to tell you what the results were. But Simon Conway Morris, he is the godfather, God person of convergent evolution. His claim is that no matter how many times the universe was started, life on our planet began, it probably would have ended up about the same as it did now. Now, you can believe that or not, but Simon Conway Morris is a Christian. And his statement is this concerning the historicity of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, and it's quite bold. He says, forget the libel. Forget the libel of the first Christians being credulous peasants and hysterical women. He says, forget it. It's not gonna fly. These were hard-nosed individuals, far more familiar with the reality of life than most of us. What was happening was simply incredible. You hardly have to read between the lines. All this crystallized in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. In those few years of Jesus' ministry, a reliable history can be reconstructed. A great statement by Simon Conway Morris. I'll see him in 12 days too. Oh, no, we're going to declare victory here. I have, we can say more, but we won't. So let me summarize. The idea that science has disproved God is silly. It's a silly idea that cannot be supported by the facts. The great science of the past were mostly Christians. Many today are Christians and able to explain how they think the Christian faith relates to their scientific pursuits. And I've tried to share a little bit of that with you this evening. Thank you for coming.
stay very long, and you've got to get back to Athens tonight. But there are these copies of this book. You can want them, so you're thank you for coming. We're just